Hello and welcome to the America Centrum's discussion tonight of Mark Twain. Thank you all so much for coming. We're always pleased to have these literary discussions because I believe that so much can be learned by the thoughts of giants like Mark Twain. We've also done programming on Edgar Allan Poe, Helen Keller, and so we find these to be very enlightening and I think a wonderful experience. And I hope you find it so too. Tonight, we are pleased to have Professor Holger Karsten, who is a lifelong learner of Mark Twain. He began his in-depth studies of Mark Twain in 1989 when he had the opportunity to go to Mark Twain's archive in Berkeley and study. Do an immersive study and actually even touch some of the writings of Mark Twain. It's a wonderful honor to have had that chance because so few people have that opportunity. He is also a professor of American literature at the University of Halle, the one near Leipzig, and he is a member of the Mark Twain Circle of America, as well as a member, one of the German American Associations of American Studies. So we are pleased to have him tonight. We have our moderator this evening, Gottfried Hufte, who, in addition to being a moderator, he is also an author of Die Welt auf dem Fischbrötchen, which is a cultural history and look at the actual history of the Fischbrötchen and how it affects and impacts culture at large. He is also a graduate of Freiburg, and where he studied history and teaching, but now he is a full-time freelance moderator, and we've been pleased to have him here tonight. Thank you, gentlemen, for coming, and thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you, Laura, for those kind words of introduction and for having us, having me, first of all, Professor Karsten and myself. And you said, Laura, the University of Halle is where Professor Karsten is teaching. That's true. The one near Leipzig, as far as I know, there's just one University of Halle, even though that Professor Karsten said before we got on air, there are many Halles as such, but there's just one university, obviously. But it's important, it's true, especially because if you have ever lived in the area, there's this sort of rivalry between Halle and Leipzig because they belong to different regional states and federal states in Germany. So it's important to give credit where credit is due, basically. Professor Karsten, I'm very, very happy, honored as well, as Laura said, because you know what you're talking about when you talk about Mark Twain. Let's put it this way. Yes, I give you that decorum at the very outset, but I'm very happy about this because I feel that we all can learn a lot from someone who is very passionate about a writer like Mark Twain. Would you agree with that?
I don't know if that's true. Well, first of all, thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank the America Centrum for inviting me. It's always a great opportunity to talk about Mark Twain for a number of reasons. I don't know. Do we hear enough about him? As far as I'm concerned, no, we can never hear enough about Mark Twain. It's always something new. And of course, recent events, I think, have shown that. That is true. He may be a 19th century author, and he died in 1910, but of course, people are still taking an active interest in him. And recent publications have shown that, yeah, contemporary Americans also are still paying attention to what's going on there. Is there something to be learned from literature? Well, that's maybe a totally different topic. Let's wait with that. Let's wait with that for a
Yeah,
little later, maybe.
let's reserve judgment until, let's say, in 75 minutes, perhaps. Which brings me very briefly to the course of today's event. We'll have a chat now for roughly 60 to 70 minutes, depending on where we end up after 60 minutes, whether we have actually come to the end of Mark Twain's life yet, because there's so much to talk about, obviously. And then you guys will have the opportunity to ask questions. There's a Q&A section column, as you may know, in Zoom. Feel free to pose your questions there. Also alongside our talk right now, but we will only review them once we get to the questions. And also, I'd like to add that this whole session is recorded and will be used as a podcast by the America Zentrum later on, which also gives you perhaps the opportunity to listen to it again or to share it with colleagues, friends, family, and other interested people who haven't had the opportunity to go and get manuscripts of Mark Twain in their hands themselves, like Professor Kersten did. So before we dive into, the day that we celebrate today, aren't we? The 119th birthday by Mark Twain in November. I'd like to ask you where you got your first contact with the works of Mark Twain. Can you remember when that was?
I do remember, and it's a curious story in a number of ways. Of course, I studied English at university, and I guess Mark Twain came up in one of the lectures about American literary history, but he didn't, that nobody actually emphasized his work in any way that made it memorable for me. No, I had been given a book by one of my aunts, and this is a German translation of Mark Twain's travel book to Germany. The original title was A Tramp Abroad, published in 1878. And I received the German translation called Ein Bummel durch Europa. And I don't know exactly, that was before I even became a student. That was when I still was still, I don't know, a teenager or something like that. And so that was my first contact. And because I, at the time, thought it was interesting to see how a foreign visitor, how an American responded to the German world that he encountered in those days, I started becoming interested, and I actually wrote my Staatsexamensarbeit about that, and everything started with that.
That's very lovely, especially because you mentioned his book, which I was obviously going to, we'll talk about this later as well, but because you mentioned the translation into German, which sort of translates back into English, I guess, as a stroll through Europe or something, even though that the original title is completely different, right? So did you pick up on that already back in the day?
I never thought about translations. To certainly, when I was a student, I always looked down on translations because I thought, well, you have to read the original. I guess that's what we were taught. Translations are, if anything, the second best thing you can do. And so I guess my sense was these people didn't know any better. So that's why
Wow. Okay.
they chose that title. The reality is, of course, it's very hard. If you're a translator and if you're translating literary texts, it's so hard. So I want to apologize for everybody, or with everybody who felt offended by my thoughts at the time. Now I know better, and I think they're doing a fabulous job, and it's so hard. And for Twain, perhaps it's even especially difficult. And we may, once we get to that topic, we may discuss the reasons why.
Luckily, there were only thoughts, as you said, so people wouldn't have a need to be offended. Well, let's dive into this time when he was born. As you said, 1835, 190 years ago, he grew up in Hannibal, Missouri. If you look at the map today, then you will find that obviously it's on the banks of the mighty river Mississippi. There is a Hannibal and an East Hannibal, so it's really at the border of today's Missouri and Illinois, and so it's rather in the north of today's state of Missouri. And he, looking back, he describes his growing up as poor but happy, perhaps even a little happier than it actually might have been, especially if we consider the fact that this parallel existence of slavery back in the day, very rough living conditions in a frontier place. That it was, and also the commerce on the river. So, how do you look at the circumstances in which Samuel Langhorne Clemens, as we should at least once call him, and after that, we are free to, from my point of view, we're free to go back to Mark Twain. So, the circumstances into which he was born.
Well, first of all, he was not born in Hannibal. He was born in another little place near Hannibal called Florida, Missouri. And as you pointed out, this was an area of the United States in 1835 that was really far removed from the cultural and political capitals of the fairly young United States at that point. You mentioned the term frontier. I don't know if everybody's familiar with that. The frontier has famously been described by an American historian, Frederick Jackson Turner, in the 1890s as the meeting point between savagery and civilization. I guess what we have to imagine here is that it's on the outskirts of settlements, basically. There wasn't much west of Missouri at the time. Missouri had become a state in 1820 or 21. And so, we're talking about a very young state. We're talking about beginning development. Sam Clemens's father had hopes of participating in what they thought might be an economic boom, because the location on the Mississippi River was something that was promising in terms of, business opportunities and those kinds of things. But he realized after a while that Florida was not the place, and so he moved his family back to further east, to Hannibal. And so Hannibal was seemed promising at the time. Located on the Mississippi River, it was possible to have steamboat landings there, and that was, of course, very important to benefit from the traffic on the Mississippi River. Still, at the time when Sam Clemens, Mark Twain, grew up in when he was young, we have to imagine Hannibal did not have more than 1,000 inhabitants, probably, right? So it was really, by modern standards, very small. But as you said, people had hopes that it might develop into something bigger. Ultimately, it didn't. And so the experience that the young boy Mark Twain had were, fairly limited, and there was not much going on in terms of culture, in terms of education. The most exciting thing for the boys was, as he recalls in the book Life on the Mississippi, that moment when a steamboat arrived, because that meant, there was something happening. People were coming, goods were being brought to the city, stories were, spread and shared. So that was exciting. But other than that, there's not he did not have a lot of exposure to anything that you would say would prepare him for a career as a writer. Not in terms of what we would classically regard as, an education, certainly not.
Well, you talk about his father. I mean, he could be viewed as a role model when it comes to working hard and trying to make or to scrape a living, actually, to provide for his family. Because, as far as I understand it, he sort of tried to work every job in the books, and he died at a young age for young Samuel, alias Mark Twain. He was only 11 years old. Do we know how he regarded, or like how that influenced him as a young child?
I don't know. I'm not sure I have all the details about that. As you said, he lost him at an early age, and so his father's influence, I don't know that we have any in-depth information about that. The fact that he had to work different kinds of jobs, you could also argue, was due to the fact that there wasn't much that he could do in terms of job stability, so he had to be flexible.
It's no judgment on him whatsoever.
And therefore, it's hard to say. Family life, there are certain moments where Mark Twain remembers his father, but I don't think we have a lot of evidence that he regarded him as a role model. One of the things that do play a role in the story of the family is that his father acquired some land in Tennessee, and he was hoping that that would be a good investment and would ultimately turn out to be, to generate money for the family. And it didn't. And this kind of hope that never sort of became a reality, became something of a fixed idea in Mark Twain's mind, and he made fun of it, and in a variety of ways. Of course, he struggled with it as well, this idea that you might become successful, or you might become financially stable or even rich. There was that hope, but it never became a reality.
And as you said, he didn't enjoy a, let's say, classical education. He tried to make up for it later on, at least when he was later trying to educate himself, sitting in libraries and reading books and stuff. Well, it has been said, I should say, that he sort of, like all the boys around that area, he had one great ambition, and that was to be a pilot or a guide for boats on the Mississippi. Well, he did get to work on the Mississippi in his early 20s, but first he set out to be a typesetter's apprentice and also a printer, basically, on the road for some years, while actually getting around quite a lot, to many places all over the place, and also while starting to write articles, his first articles. So, is it going too far to regard this time as the beginnings of his interest in, let's say, regular people, perhaps, or even the way people talk, because that's certainly something that people connect him with.
Ooh, you've mentioned a number of things here. Perhaps
Yes.
we can, tease them apart a little bit. First of all, education. That's of course something that is, difficult to define. What do we mean by an education? As far as Twain is concerned, he didn't have a formal education. He did attend school on and off basis, but he did not get any degrees, and he did not attend any kind of further education, let alone a university. Although he did get an honorary or several honorary degrees and an honorary doctorate from Oxford University later on. So libraries, I'm not sure. Maybe you have a source that I'm not familiar with. I can't think of an example like that. But
In New York,
most of
right?
the time, we're Twain scholars like to point out that he was self-educated in an informal way. So you mentioned the fact that he became an apprentice at the local newspaper that was also operated by his brother, Orion. And in that context, we forget that the job of a typesetter is really very demanding, right? You did it letter by letter, so spelling is one skill that you have to have as a typesetter, and you have to do it in reverse because, if you want to print something, it's got to be, in reverse. So that's important. Also, this is a very small newspaper. The first, these small town newspapers at the beginning didn't have more than 4 pages, really. And it was hard to fill those 4 pages with local news. So what happened at the time was that there was some kind of they call it an exchange system. So you were allowed to reprint material that other newspapers had published before, as long as you indicated the source, and most of the time they did that. Also, the newspapers at the time were quite different from ours today, because there was a wild mixture of factual reporting, but also anecdotes and, even literary material, excerpts from novels, for example. And so in that sense, he came into contact with all kinds of text types and writing styles. And clearly it appealed to him, and he was able to absorb some of that, and he developed a sense of writing and what he considered to be good writing or appropriate writing. And in that respect, we have to say that, his career as a printer, when he first started out, or that was the first path, the first step he took in the direction of becoming a writer later on. Right. And the next path, or the next career decision he made after he was a journeyman printer, and you mentioned that along the Mississippi River, different cities, he experienced that. But then he gave up on that and began to work on fulfilling the boyhood dream that you mentioned, becoming a steamboat man. That was even more attractive than, as he wrote in Life on the Mississippi, more attractive to young boys than to become a pirate or a circus clown. You know, those were the other options that they wanted to try and realize for themselves. But no, becoming a pilot on a steamboat, that was you know, one of the most important and most highly respected jobs that somebody could have. And he became an apprentice on a steamboat, and he had to learn the river. So that was quite demanding as well for him to do.
But he did talk about, well, he started to actually work on it in 1859, and he did talk about the disenchantment that it also had in store for him, because before that he regarded the river always as something, you know, obviously mighty and in so many respects greater than the people that live alongside it. And now he's just, you know, he said, I understand the water and I understand everything about it. So it's really more, it gets more technical, basically.
That's an interesting observation. And you know, the one thing about Mark Twain is, though, you can never be sure if he's telling the truth, right? So, you know, quoting Mark Twain is always risky. You never know. Is he teasing you? Is he sort of tricking you into something? You know, there are wonderful passages both in Life on the Mississippi, published in 1883, and then Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, published a year later, about the river, and where he captures the scene and the setting and talks about, you know, the impressions that nature makes on him. He's impressed by the river, and he's impressed by the, you know, everything else there. And at the same time, of course, as a pilot, he had to, as he said, he had to learn how to read the river. Because as a pilot, you were the one in charge, you know, making decisions where the boat would go. So you had to watch the surface intensively, and you had to understand, you know, what that meant if you saw ripples on the surface of the water and those kinds of things. And in that sense, he had to learn the river, to understand whether it was dangerous or not to take a certain path. I don't know if he ever lost a sense of the beauty of it.
Different beauty
I'm
forms.
not sure, but it's totally fascinating, of course, to see him write about that, right? To sort of that self-awareness that he expresses in the book, where he says, you know, it's two different things: enjoying the natural environment, but at the same time paying attention and understanding what's going on. It's not mechanical, though, because the trouble with the Mississippi River is it's shifting constantly. It was shifting constantly at the time, and therefore, you know, he had to, you know, adjust whatever decision he made all the time on every trip.
Which makes this job so much more demanding and therefore, as you said, also sort of rewarding when it comes to the way people looked at these pilots because they understood it to be a very difficult job and to be a job for which you had to have, I guess, much training, as you said, and also experience, which is funny because it sort of loops back to when you're a young one, right? If you're a young pilot, you can't have had all this experience that you might need. At least that's what you would tell sailors, for example, right? You would tell them basically you have to be 10 years older than you are right now, because that's when you get to learn to read the winds.
Yeah, that's one thing. But there's also something, you know, very practical to it. During his apprenticeship, and he again writes about that in Life on the Mississippi, his mentor basically tests him when they're on the river, and he, you know, he asks some questions. You know, what did you notice there, and where, what did you notice on the next bend of the river? And Mark Twain was totally unprepared. He didn't know that he was supposed to be paying attention. And, you know, one of the famous scenes is when he says, "Well, I was happy to be able to answer promptly, and I said I didn't know." And that creates, you know, a lot of tension. And then his mentor, his teacher, tells him to begin writing a notebook. So, you know, he was meant to He put his observations into a notebook, which he could then refer to later. So it was, even though it was kind of very flexible and fluid, he was still required to make observations and record them in writing.
Before we leave the river, at least for now, do you want to tell the brief story of how he came to his pseudonym of Mark Twain? Because there's at least one story that has been repeated many times.
It's a very contentious story. Well, most people, and for the most time, for the people like to say, of course he's called Mark Twain, because the name refers actually means something. It's very clever, because Mark is a very real first name, but it's a shout that was used on the Mississippi River by steamboat men, and Mark Twain. Calling out Mark Twain meant you're in safe water. It's 2 fathoms. The water's at least 2 fathoms and something deep. And it meant a steamboat could safely go through that passage. So, in that sense, it made, it seems very appropriate. And, it's an easy explanation. However, very recently, we've had some kind of a debate, if we want to call it that, among scholars, whether that is actually a true story or whether that's something that Mark Twain made up to protect himself. And I'm referring to an article that came out this year by my colleague, Gary Scharnhorst, who also wrote a 3-volume biography of Mark Twain, which was published, I think, 3, 4, 5 years ago. And he took issue with another article that was written before, where somebody else talked about the origin of the pseudonym, of the pen name Mark Twain. And Gary Scharnhorst, Gary makes a very strong case for the fact that the name, which he first used when he was in Virginia City in Nevada Territory, actually refers to Mark Twain's drinking habit, that he would order drinks of whiskey, and then, Mark Twain meant that the barkeep sort of took note of how many drinks he had. And that was something that is regarded by Gary Scharnhorst as the true story of the pen name. And Mark Twain then, later on, after he had left the Wild West, and I'm using quotation marks for the Wild West, when he came to the East, and when he was about to get married, or at least when he was courting Olivia Langdon, the people, her family, really, they were not happy with his reputation as the wild humorist from the Pacific coast. And so he tried to hide that part of his personal history, and later on, came up with this story, which sounds so much nicer and makes so much sense. So it's really a plausible way of describing the name.
See, this is why we talk to you and to someone who's actually studying Mark Twain on a regular basis, because this is probably something that we all would have, it would have filtered through to us once, I don't know, the next article about Mark Twain would be changed to cover that new fact, or at least let's say the new hypothesis, because as you said, your colleague has stated that this is obviously the new truth. And as always, that's, I guess, also a way to get into conversations, isn't it?
Yeah, this is quite a serious battle, actually. So there, it was published this year, and it's a serious issue. I'm sorry to say. I like to think of the Mark Twain scholar community as a friendly group, but sometimes, when things matter to us very much, we
I
tend
totally.
to overstep certain boundaries.
Talking about boundaries, perfect bridge here. The Civil War, which breaks out in 1861, so only 2 years after he has started his job on the Mississippi, among many other things that this war has brought to the land, to the people, it makes him unemployed, right? Apart from his political views and the where he stood, because he did stand with the Missouri State Guard for 2 weeks, so he was actually Well, he was intending, at least in the beginning, it seems to be, to join the war, and quits after 2 weeks. But before we get into that, and I'd want to get to his early writings then, it has been stated that he probably would have spent all his life on the Mississippi if it weren't for the war. Would you go along with that? I know it's a hypothetical, but still.
Probably true. As we've said before, it was a good job. It was a highly paid job too. It was interesting because you went up and down the river. You got in touch with a lot of people, different kind of people. So it must have been kind of intriguing as well. He said that, by the way, also in Life on the Mississippi, that whenever in literature he finds and he reads about an interesting character, he has a feeling he has met him before, met him on the river, so to say. That's a quote. He's a, I met him on the river. That's this feeling that he's come in touch with so many interesting people. So yeah, why would he have left that? It's hard to say. There would have been no reason. But then the war came and it stopped the traffic, the river traffic. He was out of a job, didn't know what to do, and by coincidence, his brother had been offered a job in the territorial government of Nevada. Nevada at the time was not a state, it was Nevada territory, but they were, in the process of creating a state. And so some government officials were sent there. Mark Twain decided to accompany his older brother because he didn't have anything else to do. And so they did this overland trip from Missouri all the way to, Virginia City. Ultimately, Carson City was the capital, so they first went to Carson. And the hope was, because we're in the 60s, 61, the American West was still associated with this notion of getting rich quick. Remember 1849, that was the gold rush when people from all over the world came to California and the gold fields. So that was over, but there were still opportunities for people to search for gold. And Mark Twain tried that because it sounded so easy. You just pick up the gold and then you're rich. It didn't work out that way for him. So ultimately, he had to find another job, a real job. And he was lucky. He came back to Virginia City, Nevada, which was also something worth mentioning. If you go to Virginia City now, it's a very small place. It would probably be unfair to call it a ghost town because people actually live there. But it's small and has nothing to do with the Virginia City of the 1870s later on. It's important to remember that both Virginia City and San Francisco were the main places at that point in time on the West Coast. And Virginia City was famous because it sat on a huge silver deposit. So it was a silver mining town and there were lots of things going on. There was money there. And they had a newspaper, or several newspapers, as a matter of fact. And so Mark Twain was able to land a job with the Territorial Enterprise.
And something that also, if you just look at it from afar, it's interesting that he sort of comes back, circles back to writing at all. Is that something that you think that he was just falling back on because he found earlier in his life already that he had a sort of a way with words, basically, and he was paid for it?
I think that's a fair guess. Yeah, there were not many things that he was able to do, and he had written short sketches and before, so he had some experience. But then he started out as a reporter. He didn't start out as somebody who was writing fictitious tales. And so reporting was needed, and there was, a desire for on the part of the population to find out about new mining ventures and things that were going on. And so that's how he got started. And then step by step, he moved into other areas when he, developed his talent as a storyteller, and he inserted his sense of humor into certain kinds of pieces that he wrote.
And fast forward at least a little bit to 1869, which was the year when The Innocents Abroad was published. And it's based on his travels through Europe and the Middle East 2 years earlier in 67. And it has been described by Thomas Fuchs, who also wrote a biography about him, as the first satire of all expense tours in Europe. Something that you would agree with? Is that something that shows his, at least his way of satire for the first time in a book?
It was his first full-length book, right? So the answer, I guess, has to be yes. Satire, humor, making fun of other people, that was part of his journalistic routine when he wrote for the Territorial Enterprise in Virginia City and also later for some San Francisco papers. But this is the his first full-length book based on the trip that you mentioned. You know, we have to realize that travel writing about Europe was a was very fashionable in the United States. There were many travel books in the US writing about Europe. Europe was regarded as the place of culture, the place where you had to go to, educate yourself in terms of, the sights that you need to see. So, in 1867, when he went there on the first tourist trip across the Atlantic, his contention was to try and see things with his own eyes, and he didn't want to repeat what other travelers had seen. And his experience was different. So, he looked at things and saw all of these ruins, and he saw that all of these castles and these things that he'd heard about and read about, that they were all in very bad repair. And so he started saying, what is this? Why are we so impressed by these things? What's so special about these ruins? And, so he adopt, the thing is, of course, one thing you have to be aware of as a reader of Mark Twain is that you shouldn't confuse the narrator, the I narrator in these books, with Mark Twain or Samuel Clemens, the person. So, he adopts a persona in his books, even if it's about his own travels. So lets them say things that do not necessarily correspond to his own beliefs. That's important to know. And, in that sense, he broke with a tradition of writing glowing accounts of trips to Europe, and he pointed out all those things that were kind of strange. And also, in another observation he made, that to every church that he visited, had a piece of the original cross. So he got suspicious.
Of course they
That's something that he thought was kind of strange. And at the same time, we also get a sense that he played a role. He played a role of the awful American who is an ignoramus, and he has scenes where he sort of just represents himself and the people he traveled with, his fellow travelers, as people who, are ignorant and don't know enough. So it's an interesting book, and it has many different facets. But clearly, the when the book came out, it became a bestseller. And it seems to be the case that the American reading public appreciated a book like this, because to a certain extent it helped boost an American sense of self-confidence, to get them out of this notion that they were just backwoods people and had nothing, and all the great culture was in Europe. So that I think that was part of both the literary history and all the cultural moment that he wrote in.
Because this is something that because we would will get to it, would get to it, but why not throw it in right now? Because this is something that has been said many times, that he sort of is the American writer of the 19th century, and there are so many possibilities to spin that, or to point at that whenever you like, and it's obviously, let's say, open to partisan interpretation, but it sort of starts at what you just said, isn't it? Because Edgar Allan Poe, his contemporary, has also been described as someone who's trying to, create a real American short story, for example. And so there these people who try to give people back home, once they have traveled, a sense of you don't have to look up at Europe. It's fine. They do their thing, and we will create our own.
Yeah, that's something that a lot of people forget because we hear a lot about American exceptionalism. And today we're more likely to think of America as a country that exaggerates its own importance, and there's a certain kind of arrogance and so on and so forth. But we should remember that in the early 19th century, the attitude, the European attitude towards Europe was pretty much that kind of arrogance to say, well, you know nothing. You have no culture, you have no literature. 1820, a famous text in which the British authors writes, "Who reads an American book?" Because the insinuation was, you have nothing, you have no music, you have no literature, you have no art. And so, for the longest time, Americans were looking for that. And they also had to try and define their own literature with regard to English literature, right? This idea, why would you think that American literature is its own category? Isn't it just a very small chapter in the big book of English literature? And so, this idea of who are we, American identity, and sort of pride, taking pride in certain kinds of achievements beyond somehow covering territory and enlarging the nation, what is there in terms of culture, right? That was a big debate, and Mark Twain, to a certain extent, helped define something that people wanted to see as American, right? Because that's a challenge. What is that?
Definitely.
What is that central element? And the discovery of the American West helped with that, right? An area that did not, was very unlike many of the things that Europeans knew. The kinds of societies that Mark Twain was writing about, something that was new to Europeans. And also, of course, the way of writing about it. You mentioned Edgar Allan Poe, who clearly wrote in the tradition of European Romanticism. He did make an attempt and say, well, there's this new genre. He didn't use that word, and he didn't talk about short story. He called it prose narrative. But that's somehow, occurred a little later. But Mark Twain and those people who were paying attention to specific regional characteristics and tried to capture the spirit of a particular region were at first labeled local colorists, right? People who wrote about specific locations and the idiosyncrasies of certain individuals, and in that sense helped move the focus away from, the imaginary worlds of romanticism to real life events on American territory.
And before we get to the, at least to my mind, the fascination of, well, like my fascination of why travel literature back in the day was so popular. You mentioned the self-importance maybe that American readers could take from this. I was always wondering why traveling at all back in the day. This is where we leave basically the chronology of Twain's life for a moment, because it was still, at least in the 1860s, at least in the 90s, it was a little different. Also because his pockets were a bit more filled with possibilities to make it more comfortable when he was traveling. In the 60s, it wasn't, and so it was very tedious to travel for a long time. It was risky still, and it was uncomfortable usually, and it was probably also expensive. So especially going overseas, and he did that a lot, not just to Europe. Why do that?
I think he decided to get away from San Francisco and the West for a number of reasons, personal reasons as well. He had made enemies and he wanted to get away, but he also was ready for a new step in his career. So this opportunity to go on that trip was a chance for him to gather material. And the trip was partly paid for by newspapers that hired him to a certain extent, and he wrote travel letters back while he was in Europe, and he sent back those travel letters, and they would be printed in American newspapers. And later on, he used those travel letters as a basis to compose his book, right? So clearly, there was an interest on the part of these newspapers to send a reporter over there to see what this wonderful new trip to Europe would yield. And Twain was happy to take the opportunity and become involved in such a prestigious event. And of course, I guess he was curious about Europe as well to kind of find out what was going on.
And it's because you mentioned earlier that, let's say, the factual part of his works, like really doing reporting as we understand it, of like today by journalistic standards, and also the fictional part of it was in one of the same newspaper, often next to each other, in any case. But also in his works, it was often said that they sort of intertwined. And rightly so, maybe, because the reading, or like the market, the readers were actually interested in a fictional aspect of it, perhaps. And that's why, this is my question, I guess, his reportings, right, from Europe and other places were so fascinating to people, because they go way beyond just descriptions and retellings of what he's experiencing there.
Oh, definitely. But by the time, he first became a national phenomenon with a sketch that is called The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, published in 1865. And that was printed in a New York publication. And that by that time, sort of his reputation as a humorist was pretty much established. And so people expected texts written by Mark Twain to be at least entertaining, if not humorous, funny, right? And so I think that's also part of it, something to take into consideration, that he was under that kind of, well, I think pressure is the right word, because later in life he felt it was very limiting to be considered a humorist, because that prevented him from writing other things. People didn't want to see any kind of serious writing coming from Mark Twain. One book that he wrote about Joan of Arc, he was interested in history in a number of ways. He wrote a book about Joan of Arc. He first published it under a pseudonym because he was worried that people might think that this is some kind of a humorous history of Joan of Arc, right? And in other senses as well. I mean, he felt that he was typecast, that he always had to fulfill this role and the expectation of a clown, of a joker, a fun maker. But at the time, of course, it was excellent for him because it, proved to be a wonderful source of money for him. If he wrote humorous books, there was clearly a market for that, and he was successful in, benefiting from that.
Was he sort of standing on the shoulders of giants before him in that sense, where like this sort of way of writing, this satirical, often ironic view on things, commenting on things, was that new, at least to the American market?
As we said before, clearly he had no education, no formal education. He had come in touch with all kinds of writers. I don't think there was a model for his humor. I think that's a very genuine form. It's very unique. And I think the fact that he is, most of the time, he is regarded as a humorist, and that he cultivated that image, even though he didn't like it all the time, I think speaks to the fact that there was something special about it. Of course, he is, there are regional traditions. Mark Twain didn't come out of nothing. He was familiar with the various types of humorous groups that existed at the time. But still, the fact that we remember him and not the other people who were all the time, I think, is an indication that he had something that made him more memorable and gave his writing a more lasting element.
And if we now turn to the, let's say, 1870s, 80s, so he moves with, well, he marries, first of all, Olivia Langton, as you said, tried to court her for many years. Finally, it worked out, partly because he had a dubious reputation, and the father of Olivia did some research on him, because I think it's fair to say that he sort of married up in the hierarchy of society, because they were coming from great stock, as you would at least in England probably call it.
Yeah, definitely.
That wasn't the, but wait, that wasn't the question. The question is, so they moved to Connecticut and lived there for many years to come, and this is the period where probably most of his best known books, greatest books, originate from. Before we get into at least some of them briefly, looking at the time, it is often said that it is a, because this is something that I haven't mentioned yet, it's a comic seriousness that is addressed or at least associated with him. And also, obviously, he's associated with the American realism, something that is a genre. So is it this style of writing, acknowledging obviously that there are many different types of works that he did, this style of writing of close-ups on people, regular people, right? Of everyday life, something that he just stumbled into? Or is it something that he observed and realized this is something I can make money with?
Ooh, that's
I
definitely a
realize
lot
it's
of
two questions in
questions.
one, I guess.
Yeah, he took an interest in everyday life and in everyday people. He had no patience for romantic writing, and he, I think, felt very strongly about the areas that he inhabited. And it's perhaps no coincidence that his most important books, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Life on the Mississippi, the Mississippi River books that they, and Pudd'nhead Wilson, that they are all located in that area, the Mississippi River area. He never had any ambition beyond that. I mean, he was, even though he met important people, he met millionaires, he met the German Emperor, he met with royalty in other places. He never really, made them an object of his writing. I don't know. That's I don't I don't think I have an answer for that. I'm not sure he ever explicitly expressed that, why he chose that. I guess it these were stories he wanted to tell.
But the involvement of especially these local idioms, dialects, which is obviously for the works that you mentioned, is so important and so catching for so many people. So this is why I always sort of how should I put this? I always thought that this probably is one of the reasons it took off so big back in the day.
Yeah, perhaps we can say that. He was never, he was writing, he was paying attention to everyday characters. He was paying attention to their language. It was important to him to render that. He was a good storyteller, and that resonated with readers. And the fact that he also tapped into an audience that was not an educated audience, I think, confirms this notion. He all of his the majority of his books were published by subscription, so they were not available in bookstores, which is understandable if you think about areas that didn't have bookstores. And the people who bought these kinds of books were, mechanics and farmers, right? And they, I guess there was something attractive to them about the writing style, the down-to-earth humor, the certain kind of, well, satirical view of life, perhaps as well, and the entertainment factor. It's sort of it's just made you, certain passages in Twain make you smile. Sometimes you laugh if you read a book, if that's, believable or not. Sometimes it's really enjoyable, which doesn't mean that he's telling jokes, right? It's about situations, and it's about various configurations and, how people, interact with each other. But then again, none of his books is really, or, I think you can argue very few of his books are really lighthearted and just superficial in that sense. There's always something below the surface that gives these superficially entertaining and humorous texts a something for you to think about.
And which is the place that we arrive, because when we look at the time that we're talking about, then we're talking about, let's say, 10 to 15 years after the Civil War. And which brings us to the question of what topics are under the surface that he's trying to cover, that bother him, that he feels strongly about, that he's then putting into his writing. And if we talk about, for example, about this the two very famous books of The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn and The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, I think go about it like, is there room and a market for these types of topics so shortly after the Civil War? And did he know that, or did he just try out and see?
There was no market research. He had no way of knowing what would appeal to a large public. He benefited from his reputation that was established early on. Not all of his books were bestsellers. He was slightly disappointed in the sales of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, even though it was not a failure or anything like that. But then, of course, we have to perhaps be aware that reading a book as an academic is one thing, and reading a book for entertainment purposes only is quite another thing. So it's hard to know what the reader, in inverted commas, the reader in 19th century readers actually made of these books. Tom Sawyer is fairly harmless. Not certainly not the same level of complication that Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is, where you, as you pointed out, where it's centrally about the story of an escaped slave.
And
But
which
you
is
have to
also very,
realize,
very
one thing about before we get into the details, there's one thing. If you look at Mark Twain's writing as a whole, you might discover a certain kind of worldview. A worldview that was characterized by a certain sense of frustration, perhaps disappointment of life in general. And this is something that became very relevant in his later years. I mean, he had a fairly negative view of humanity. And he had been in touch with, all kinds of situations, both in Hannibal and also in the American West. He had seen violence in many sorts, and the number of violent episodes in Huckleberry Finn is quite striking. There's a quote from his later years where he says, "All I care to know is that a man is a human being. That's enough for me. He can't be any worse." So, a certain disillusionment with human nature is something that is characteristic for all of his writing, and I think you can discover it in many, many texts. The case of Huckleberry Finn, of course, has become so prominent because scholarship really has zoomed in on that particular book. And when it was first published, it wasn't regarded as particularly powerful or particularly well written. On the contrary, Concord Public Library censored the book and, didn't make it available to people. There were a number of negative reviews. And some people say it wasn't until Ernest Hemingway actually said, all American literature comes from this one book, and that's Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. And, ever since that time, people have been interested in finding out more about it. I think we can also talk about it in the context of what we said earlier, American culture, American literature looking for the great American novel, that one book that somehow captures the American spirit. And here with Huckleberry Finn, you have something, it's the location, of course, is very American. Mississippi River, the Civil War, as a context is very American, and the problem of slavery is also, typically American for that period of time. So you can enumerate a number of formal factors. You would say this is something that is crucial and very, very specific.
And it also, because as you said, Hemingway later on also comes back to that, but his fame was also already underway in his lifetime. So many, as in contrast to many other writers who earned their peak of fame after their demise, in his case, he was already very famous back in the day. So at least when he wrote those famous books, even though they weren't his bestsellers, as you said. So were people expecting bestsellers from him already? So was there a different pressure on him as a writer? Because we know that he was in debt in the 90s due to unlucky investments. But so we know that he was handling a lot of money.
Well, first of all, he was interested in writing bestsellers because, as you said, he wanted to earn money from it. That's one thing. Then again, I think it's really important to distinguish between audiences. So, the literary establishment located in, the East Coast cities in Boston, Philadelphia, and so on, they were not really convinced that Mark Twain deserved attention. And it took a while to be accepted into that sphere, so to say, right? And it happened, I think, mostly by way of his friendship with William Dean Howells, who was a an editor of influential literary magazines such as The Atlantic and Harper's for a while. And they became friends. And they, had a very important and long correspondence, in which they also talked about literary matters. And Twain always emphasized that he was not writing for an elite. He was writing for the average reader, right? And so in that sense, of course, the title that you chose for this interview, a classic, an American classic in Europe, Mark Twain is very skeptical about the word classic. He defined it at one point. A classic is something that everybody wants to have read, but nobody wants to read. And so,
It's, yeah, it's like Shakespeare.
that's one thing. And the other distinction that he made when he wrote about literature, and it goes like this: high and fine literature is wine, and mine is only water, but everybody likes water. And everybody drinks water. So, it has something to do with his realization that he did not live up to those refined standards, cultural and literary standards that were important for, the established East Coast authors. But he had developed, his own style, which appealed to other kinds of people. Now, Howells realized that the focus on, as you said, issues of realism was really something new in literature, and therefore he also supported him, apart from the fact that they became friends. But that's something I think to remember when we talk about audience and reception. Who are we talking about? The general readership, or are we talking about the literary arbiters in those places such as Boston?
Well, I probably when I'm thinking of the voices giving him perhaps this label of the American author, funnily enough, those probably are academics saying that. But
Not
I always
necessarily.
feel no, okay, but I always think of no, these are the readers saying that because due to the fact of the reason that you said, like where the stories are situated, who is actually talking, these psychological insights into his characters, who are everyday people, or at least people that are familiar to folks reading his stories in some sense. So when he's described as the encapsulation of American heart and American soul, some people go as far as calling him, and I like that a lot because I totally like a good exaggeration. Then I always think about that. I don't think about elites on the coasts, to use a very common trope.
That's probably that's a moment where we have to distinguish in terms of time. When did the person say that? So that complicates issues further. His first biographer, Albert Bigelow Paine, who was also his literary executor, who lived with Twain during the final years of his life, and then wrote the first most comprehensive biography of Mark Twain. He wrote in that biography, "Mark Twain is the man most characteristically American in every thought and mood and action of his life." And so, that was something that he felt. And then, similarly, the biography clearly came out after Twain had died. And William Dean Howells, his friend and also literary writer, also wrote a book about Mark Twain called My Mark Twain, in which he shares memories of Mark Twain and talks about his literature as well. I have a quote from him here because I was thinking about this question of Americanness and not Americanness. So William Dean Howells wrote, "Those poor Germans, Austrians, Englishmen, and Frenchmen who have been from time to time in the last 10 years trying to show their esteem for his," that is Mark Twain's, "peculiar gifts, could never come as close to the heart of his humor as we could. We might well doubt if they could fathom all his wisdom, which begins and ends in his humor." So he actually says, well, you can only understand him if you're American, right? So that, to a certain extent, confirms your idea that some people take him to be very, very American and characteristically American. At the same time, that contrasts so sharply with the fact that his works have been translated into so many different languages, and that he's popular all over the world, basically. Right? There is a book that came out in the 1980s, I forget the exact date, a scholar named Rodney, Mark Twain International. And this is a huge research project where he documented all the translations in the world that had been made of Mark Twain's works. And so, that I think is a very powerful argument to say, well, why would so many readers in the world, and not just readers, but clearly publishing companies who want to sell these books, why would they be able to do that if we're talking about a hermetic text that is American and exclusively American and not accessible to people outside of the country?
It depends on, and this is also looking at the time, we sort of have to move to a perception of what we talk about reception already. I'm curious because we chose this title for today, how the European market and how he thought about the European market when thinking about, especially we talked about a translation in the very beginning, and about now this Americanness of his text, whether they are understood over there, or whether his style of writing is understood, his humor. And apparently, as you said, it goes to show, you could say, it is. Otherwise, people wouldn't have bought it and wouldn't enjoy it.
Yeah, I guess that's it's a sort of a if you take that as an argument to say, if you're selling books, there's got to be something attractive there. But there's another conundrum about it, right? Because all of these people who are reading Twain in translation, reading Twain in translation, so they're not the reading the real Twain. So everything that's special about his use of language, which is something that he's been celebrated for, they're getting none of that. So, that's truly remarkable. So it can't be the language only. There has to be something else as well. And we briefly touched upon this notion of translating texts and Huckleberry Finn in particular. What do you do? How do you translate a novel that is written in non-standard language, right? He has a preface to his text. He says that he intentionally tried to render local and regional dialects from Missouri, and of course he reproduces the speech of Jim, the African American enslaved man, and these are all forms that are specific to the region. Now, how do you transfer that into any other language? That's quite a big question to ask, and I have no answer, so in case you were wondering.
Well, first of all, I love the fact that you said conundrum. I haven't heard that word in a while. It's very nice. And it gets even more interesting when you think about that he writes about language, for example, about the German language, famously, in English, which then is translated into German, read by Germans, right? And thinking about how he basically makes fun of German language and how it's impossible to learn or at least to pronounce, and how the long the sentences go over pages and stuff. So so the conundrum develops itself, I feel. So it's like Lost in Translation, basically. Turning to a couple of last questions, when we think about him after his demise in 1910, to pinpoint it, and we talked about it when we talked about him a couple of weeks ago, I think it's fair to say that many people regard him, or at least associate him, with Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer, and therefore as a sort of children's books author. They sort of think of these books and of him as, oh well, yeah, that's the two very jolly fellows from the Mississippi River. And I think my question is, how did that come to turn out like that? Because with everything we said now is basically completely pointing in another direction. He was really concerned with huge topics of the day, political ones, sociological ones. So it's completely not the case that he's writing books for children.
Yeah. Are we talking about the United States or are we talking about Germany? Because
In this
there's
case,
a
let's
difference
go with
there.
Germany because this is where we are located.
Yeah. I do think that the translations play a role in that. And not only the translations, I'm currently involved in a project which we're looking at illustrations in Huckleberry Finn. Something we haven't mentioned so far is that all of Mark Twain's books, when they originally were published, had illustrations, lots and lots of illustrations, and that was part of the attraction of these books. And that is, that's something that is quite remarkable because usually not many novels in the 19th century, second half of the 19th century, were illustrated. So to a certain extent, you might say, people tend to think of illustrated books as children's books
See.
to certain later on, the when they were reprinted in by by other publishers, these illustrations were left out, and most people that's why most people don't know that all of these books were originally published with illustrations. When they came to Germany, many books were only published in the first edition that we have were not reprinted in the original form, and certainly they did not have the illustrations. But when the illustrations were introduced, you can clearly see that over time, and so far we've only looked at the illustrations up to the 1950s, they become more and more oriented towards children. If you look at the original illustrations, you might say these are not. Yeah, th these are okay. They resemble illustrations that you've found in periodicals, magazines, in 19th century America. But in that sense, it's clearly visible that the illustrations somehow are aimed at a juvenile audience. The question of what is actually represented is also, open to debate. I've discovered that some early translations didn't even include all the chapters. Passages were left out. In that sense, this notion of the boys that you mentioned, the boys having fun, was sort of was overemphasized, I guess. And I don't know if it's fair to say that a German readership had not enough sense of what the period he was writing about. The time of of American slavery and what that meant, and how anybody could think of an enslaved person trying to run away to find a job and make money and buy his wife and daughter, how that could be an element in a humorous book. Unless you don't make that connection that this was realism, as you said before, right? This happened. And maybe a lot of readers with the distance that we were talking about felt that, yeah, it's just an invented story. There's some sadness there, but everything will end up okay. And of course, that's a big criticism that the novel had to face, that the ending of the novel really is an evasion. It's an escape. It doesn't really resolve the conflict. Mark Twain has been criticized for, the final chapters of his book, Huckleberry Finn, because it does not resolve the underlying conflict. So those may be some points that the book has certainly in Germany never received that appreciation that it received in the United States after a while. As I said, not from the beginning, but really, this is a 20th century phenomenon.
Which sort of reminds me of our earlier thoughts on the Americanness of it all and how unique it might be to the American history, especially the very recent history of, a couple of like the 20 years earlier. So you had to perhaps be very familiar with what it all, what he represents in those books in order to understand the bigger picture, basically. And if you're someone in Europe, both back in the day and perhaps even, let's say, 80 years later, 100 years later, so 50 years ago or something, then you might not connect those dots. You might know it references the war and many many problems with both with segregation, slavery that still existed after the war, and so on. But you didn't really make the connection that this is real, as you said, and that it might still be sort of fictional, an exaggeration of a bad situation. So maybe it's that, yeah. But looking at the time, I'd like now to take the opportunity to give you the opportunity to ask questions if you have any. So where do you, in a very broad sense, in America, for example, and in Europe, see his standing in 2025?
All right. Well, as I said at the very beginning, I think this year is a great example that shows that Mark Twain is very much alive in people's minds. The book that came out in 2024, Percival Everett's James, is based on Mark Twain's novel, and it retells a part of the plot in Adventures of Huckleberry Finn from the perspective of Jim, who was called James in his novel. And that book created a lot of public attention. It was awarded the Pulitzer Prize and other prizes as well. So the fact that this can happen, I think, testifies to the fact that Mark Twain's original story still resonates. That you can, you can do what Percival Everett did. I'm not sure you can do that with many other novels that were written in the United States. The same time, a new biography written by Ron Chernow also came out, 1,200 pages, a very, very big book. And once again, he's a very well-regarded biographer. He's known for, many other biographies that he's written. The fact that he has turned to Mark Twain now, I think, says something. It's not that we don't have biographies of Mark Twain. We have many, right? And then, of course, Shelley Fisher Fishkin, who's a Mark Twain scholar, one of the most prominent Mark Twain scholars that we have, also came out with a new book entitled Jim, in which she addresses the problematic nature of the character of Jim. And it's always been her intention to defend the novel and Mark Twain against accusations of racism. So we have three major publications connecting with a writer, who died in 1910. So I think the fact that that people are dealing with Mark Twain, that you, and this is something that you pointed out, that publishing houses are willing to print those books and distribute them. I think they testify to the fact that, yeah, Twain had lots of things to say, and many of the topics he addressed are still relevant and can be discussed in new ways.
I see. I have a question here from someone in the audience. Well, I guess it's a couple of questions, but I'll just read them out to you. I don't know whether you can see them as well. I'll just read them out anyway. So, was he more proud of his books rather than discontent or doubting? Was he once directly asked and said that he liked all books he wrote, or there were some that he should never bring out to the readers because he disliked it at the end that much? And
Yeah,
so, what do you
it's
think?
difficult to speak about his books because they're all very different. It has been said that he didn't have a good sense of what his good books were. So he did not necessarily regard Adventures of Huckleberry Finn as his best book. For there are we have I think we have some evidence where he writes that he thought Joan of Arc was his best book. And so, you know, his own judgment about his own achievement is not to be trusted. He knew or he saw that some books were popular, and that I think gave him confidence that he might be able to do that. Perhaps another thing to mention, you know, he was very self-conscious. So, you know, in the early days when he decided to become a writer, and he was still a journalist in Virginia City, Nevada, he writes a letter to his mother. And it's very interesting how he says that he decided to become a writer of books of the lower kind, namely humorous books, right? So that also tells you something about the status that humorous writing had in the United States at that time among the literary elite. So, you know, I think he was conflicted about some of the things that he wrote. He was never sure about anything. And then, of course, you know, he was very serious about withholding his true opinion about the human race and about religion. So he wrote, we have many manuscripts that were not published during his lifetime. And as a matter of fact, even his autobiographical dictations, which finally came out in 2010, and you know, and the years after that, in three volumes edited by the Mark Twain Project in Berkeley, you know, he said that this material can only be published 100 years after his death. And the reason was that he felt he wanted to say things that would not be popular with his readers. And so he wanted to protect his own reputation. He wanted to protect the people that he knew. And somehow he felt that what he had to say about life and about religion and about God was too harsh and too strong for people to accept. And so, you know, that I think that's a That's a an attempt at a differentiated response to this kind of question. Was he proud or wasn't he? Yeah, it's a mixed bag again.
Well, that sort of brings us to the end of our time here, and I'd like to end on a question that I was thinking about for a while now when thinking about Mark Twain and where we meet him when we're around scholars like you and visiting university every day. Then we meet him often with a vast amount of witty aphorisms, comments on life that are often obviously just associated with him, and we don't know whether he actually said those. I think he's second maybe only to Oscar Wilde when it comes to that, or Confucius perhaps, but many we know are probably from him. Comments on, as you mentioned before, people, life, nature, religion, so many things. Why do you think, Professor Kasten, is that? What's the reason we have so many of those clever, witty things that he left us?
Well, he himself, of course, liked to come up with these witty sayings. Well, first of all, you know, many of the quotations that you find have been taken from his books. But he also personally had an interest in actually generating these witty sayings. So we know this because we have his notebooks, and we can see how he tested some variations of, you know, saying something clever. Puddin'head Wilson, and Following the Equator, in those books, he actually uses those funny sayings as, you know, lines right after the chapter begins, and they don't necessarily are con they're not necessarily connected with the actual writing. I guess it's something he liked somehow to say something in very short form, and to make it stick. So, you know, he was you know, as I think as we indicated, he was very peculiar about language, and language mattered to him. And he has there are a number of texts where he writes about style and says, you know, James Fenimore Cooper is totally unacceptable. You can't read him. It's just, you know, totally artificial language and it's boring. And he always insisted that you have to find the exactly the right word for something. He said that one, this is one of the sayings, the difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between the lightning and the lightning bug. So, wittiness, cleverness, but at the same time, he felt that way. It mattered to him. And if you look at his manuscripts and the revisions that he made, it's totally clear that he paid a lot of attention to language, and so maybe this was a way for him to somehow compress as much meaning as possible into a sentence, and at the same time, give it a certain twist that memorable, and in that sense, funny, perhaps, right?
And you know what is so liberating when thinking about this is that he was not educated in a classical sense. That he was not, like, especially when we live in a time where academic standards are held very high, rightly so in some cases. In other cases, I might have questions on that. But it is thought of as the entry towards wittiness and towards writing as such, I guess, still in our day and age. And he is a perfect example for the contrary, basically. And it's something this is very heartwarming.
Perhaps we can add one more thing about, because education, that's such a difficult thing to deal with. He liked to portray himself as a man of the people and somebody who's very down to earth and who didn't have an education. And that's all true. At the same time, throughout his life, he was a voracious reader. And another extremely useful publication that was created by another Mark Twain scholar by the name of Alan Gribben is called Mark Twain's Literary Resources. And it's a work of a lifetime. And he collected information about all the books that Mark Twain read throughout his entire life. So this is a dictionary reference book type of publication in alphabetical order. So you can look up Dickens, and you can look up all the other authors, even Goethe, and all the books that he possessed in his personal library, and the books that he read in the library of his father-in-law, where he sometimes annotated certain passages. So, if you take that into consideration, you can see that here's somebody who took an immense interest in writing and in the thoughts of other people as well.
True, but still self-taught,
Yeah, which, it's something that we find hard to understand, because who wants to do that if you can scroll through your Instagram feed?
Whatever makes sense, yes.
Let me make one more recommendation here, perhaps, because you talked about the quotations and the fact that many of them are inaccurate. Everybody who's interested in Mark Twain's quotations, I want to point you to a webpage called twainquotes.com. And that is your ultimate source. Barbara Schmidt, who runs that website, is a wonderful researcher, and she's had that website for many, many years. And she also and quotations that have been attributed to Twain, but we've never found any evidence. She'll comment on that too. And it's organized alphabetically, so if you're looking for something in particular, then you can find it there. So, for example, truth, right? If you wanted to find out if Twain ever said something about truth, you go to the T section and you find something like, "Truth is the most valuable thing we have. Let's economize it." So those kinds of things. So wonderful resource.
Thank you very much. That's very helpful, I'm sure, because especially when we don't want to step into using phrases that we then claim uttered by Mark Twain, and then we find out it's not, especially when we want to write them somewhere, for example, your Instagram feed, perhaps, because you just mentioned that. Professor Kasten, I'm saddened by the fact that we are already coming to a close. I'm very, very happy and grateful, thankful to you and to the America Centrum for giving us the opportunity to have this talk today. I learned a lot again, and I'm now in the middle of deciding which book of Twain I'm going to pick up next, because because you have hinted at so many possibilities to get in contact with Twain again today. So that's I'm rather torn right now. So I will sleep over it, and then tomorrow I'll decide. So thank you very much for being here.
Final comment, whatever book you pick, make sure it's the original version, not a translation, and
Definitely.
that it has the illustrations. So you want to get the real feeling of what it was like to read a Mark Twain
You
book.
made that very clear today, so I will be sure to do that. Yes. So thank you very much for your time, and thank you for doing this.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Okay, so we'll hand over to Laura and to everybody from America Centrum. Thank you, Laura.
Well, I just wanted to say thank you once again. It is always enlightening for us to hear these talks, and we are really happy that we have an opportunity to sponsor them. Thank you all so much. Have a great evening.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americazentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americazentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americazentrum.de. Thanks for listening.